Hello, everyone. Welcome to our inaugural presentation today in Brain Trust, Conversations in Psychopharmacology. I'm Dr. Joe Goldberg. I'm clinical professor of psychiatry at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. It's my pleasure to be your host in this new video series being sponsored by Psychiatric Times, where we'll have a chance to talk with experts in clinical psychopharmacology on topics that are front of mind, controversial, unresolved, or at least should be in your own thinking as a clinical prescriber, psychiatrist, mental health practitioner, or otherwise thinking about what's really current and topical in psychopharmacology. Our guest today is Dr. Marlene Freeman. She's professor of psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School. She's the associate director of the Center for Women's Mental Health at the Mass General Hospital and the Abra Prentice Foundation Chair in Women's Mental Health at MGH. She is the medical director of the Clinical Trials Network and Institute at MGH. Dr. Freeman completed medical school at our mutual alma mater, Northwestern Medical School, followed by a residency at Harvard Longwood and research fellowship in biological psychiatry at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine. And she previously directed women's mental health programs at the University of Arizona College of Medicine and UT Southwestern Medical Center at Dallas. Dr. Freeman is editor-in-chief of the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry. She's on the board of directors of the American Society of Clinical Psychopharmacology, where she's also a fellow, and a fellow of the American College of Neuropsychopharmacology, and a member and volunteer for Postpartum Support International. So Marlene, I asked you for three reasons today on this inaugural program. First and foremost, as a longtime friend and colleague, I hope you'll go easy on me if I ask or say anything that's not to your liking. Number two, the topic of reproductive health and psychopharmacology is something that I think most people think they know more about than they do. And so there's an awful lot of potential misinformation out there. And to have an expert authority such as yourself give us some guidance is really invaluable. And last but not least is the timeliness factor of this meeting today. So I'm going to start us out with acknowledging that on July 21st this year, the FDA convened a panel on the topic of SSRIs in pregnancy. And there were a lot of issues that came out of that panel discussion about the potential risks versus safety of SSRIs in pregnancy. So Marlene, I'd like to start off by asking you, what do you think that panel got right and didn't get right? And what was your reaction to it overall?
So first, thank you so much for having me. And also thank you for inviting me to speak on a topic that I feel is so important. And I really hope that healthcare providers of multiple disciplines, you know, tune in, because there are definitely things that I want to make sure after a panel like that people really know. So one issue that any prescriber should keep in mind is that for women of reproductive potential, the rate of unplanned pregnancies in this country is about 50%. So whenever we're writing prescriptions or deciding on treatment plans, we want to keep in mind that even if a woman is not planning on becoming pregnant at the time, if she might become pregnant at some time, we always want to keep in mind the reproductive safety of the medications that we're using. And that includes what we select for girls and young women as well, because so many of the disorders we treat are chronic or recurrent, and we want to make sure that there's a reasonable plan for medication use across pregnancy, because so many of our patients have moderate to severe illness and will need treatment across pregnancy and postpartum. And so that's one of the things that tends to get underscored, are the risks of untreated psychiatric illnesses during pregnancy and the postpartum. So what I explain to patients, and what I explain when there's a confusing message from somewhere about use of psychiatric medications during pregnancy, is I always start with the risks of untreated illness. So we know with all the major psychiatric disorders that have been studied across pregnancy, that the disorder itself carries risk for the individual, the pregnancy, outcomes postpartum, and for the baby, and really for child development. So there's an increased risk of obstetrical and neonatal complications. There may be long-term neurodevelopmental consequences. And we know that there's potential risk of the untreated illness itself, which can create a more stressful environment for the fetus, and it may also lead to poor self-care and engagement in prenatal health with the individual. But there are also so many other potential variables that are impacted, like use of substances, you know, tobacco, alcohol, smoking. We're seeing so many women using cannabis now and assuming it's safe during pregnancy. more women with psychiatric disorders are obese than the general population, which is a major risk factor for basically every obstetrical complication and also major malformations. Many of our patients don't have adequate social support or good nutrition or get regular exercise. So we have to keep in mind all those factors when we're talking about treatment versus non-treatment. So my close colleague, Lee Cohen, in assessing risk of a medication always says succinctly, compared to what? And it's compared to the untreated illness. Because it's if we look at women who are on a medication during pregnancy versus those not on a medication during pregnancy, those groups will differ by more than just exposure to the medication. They're probably groups that are quite different for a lot of reasons. The other thing is that women can have the same diagnosis but different severities. So we suspect that women who have more serious illness are likely to take a medication during pregnancy than not. That said, too.
I'm sorry, yes? If I could just interrupt on that point before I lose you on this. So one of the comments that was made by one of the panelists was something along the lines of, you know, depression isn't necessarily a medical illness and we should just let it pass. What's wrong with that statement?
Well, I think most people realize that there are serious psychiatric disorders that affect individuals and their families, and we have a job as a field to take these illnesses seriously and provide psychoeducation everywhere we turn. So to our colleagues, to the public. And, you know, I think in recent years, there's actually been great campaigns to educate, especially about postpartum depression, less so about depression during the pregnancies. But I think we've actually come a long way. It's unusual to hear people so dismissive of psychiatric disorders and the suffering that they cause. And one of the reasons that drew me to perinatal psychiatry was the opportunity not only to treat the individual woman during such a vulnerable time in her life, but also to affect the children, the baby and the child, other kids in the home, entire families. And so by treating one person who's central to the family, you really improve the mental health of the entire family. And so one of the things in psychiatry that is more studied than almost anything else are the risks of maternal depression on child development. So that includes postpartum depression and maternal depression. And we know that almost every aspect of child development is negatively impacted by having a mother who's depressed. And I would say we can extend that to other psychiatric disorders. They're just not as well studied as depression. So I think that it's, you know, I think we're so beyond the conversation of whether psychiatric disorders are real or not. Like, we know that they're suffering. We know that they impact, you know, really every aspect of the prenatal health of a woman who has a psychiatric disorder, that everything's interrelated. Having an untreated psychiatric disorder increases stress. The other thing too is, you know, that if a woman is not well during pregnancy in terms of a psychiatric disorder, then the natural course of that is to get much worse abruptly in the postpartum. So for most illnesses, if someone is doing what she thinks is the best thing for her baby and not pursuing treatment or taking a medication, if she's really unwell at the time of delivery, the risk of her being much, much worse and experiencing severe postpartum psychiatric illness is very high. So the last thing we want is for women to be taking new babies home from the hospital being unwell, because, you know, as any of you who are parents can understand, you know, the needs of a new baby in terms of the emotional demands and the physical demands are so high that we want people to be at the top of their game. We don't want them suffering from a severe illness, and sometimes medications take a while to work, so they may spend weeks or months recovering. So we want to make sure, like, by the end of a pregnancy, I share with patients that I want their goal to be rock solid stable, like well. And then after delivery, I want them to know that they will be at risk. So I always take the opportunity during pregnancy to meet with a woman, and if she has a partner, bring the partner into the conversation about what to watch for postpartum in terms of symptoms, how to differentiate between what is normal in the postpartum and what are symptoms that are emerging. So So it's a really vulnerable time. And I really think that we need to make sure that first and center in the conversation is the treatment of the illness and discussion of the illness.
So let me make sure I understand something. So pregnancy itself is a high risk time for depression in the lives of women? Or?
So not really, actually. So it's for some women, it might be. But for most people, it's neutral. So the risk of relapse or continuation of a depressive episode is probably about the same in pregnancy or not, and probably the same for bipolar disorder. But the issue is that when women discontinue medication that they've been maintained on, there is a very high risk of recurrence. So this is the context where we see probably the most individuals trying to come off their medicine, either planning for pregnancy or during a pregnancy. And very often, understandably, patients are terrified if they find out they're pregnant and they're on a psychiatric medication. So what we often see is patients abruptly stop the medication, relapse to illness, and come in for treatment really unwell. And oftentimes when that happens, patients are really destabilized. It's not as simple as just putting back the medication and they're fine. Many patients end up on more medication than they started on. Oftentimes people have to be hospitalized. If a woman's planning pregnancy, it may delay her plan to conceive, which may, you know, if she's in her late 30s, you know, that could impact fertility, or early 40s. We often see patients around that. So there are consequences to stopping medication, but the risk of recurrence is probably about the same if treatment is about the same.
And the biology of depression has direct known negative effects on the fetal development and obstetrical course, right? Just to differentiate what the panel didn't so much differentiate about, what is attributable to the illness of depression from possible impacts of medicines? That must be really hard to parse out. Although we do know things about what untreated depression can do to a developing fetus and the course of pregnancy.
Right. So there have been good studies that look at the risks of depression and anxiety, you know, across those, and impact on pregnancy without medication. And there also have been sophisticated studies that look at women with depression on medication and with depression who are not on medication, and then normal controls, no medicine, no depression, and in order to make these comparisons so that we can speak more clearly to what may be the risk of antidepressant alone. And so what's so important about any study, so we have so many studies now on SSRIs over the past few decades about SSRIs and pregnancy.
And they're hardly understudied, right?
Right, they're not. But this is a situation that we have to be tentative to say, but we need more research, because what we need is really high quality, you know, research, because there are so many confounding variables. And some studies are weak in terms of not controlling for confounding variables, including psychiatric illness, you know, not having comparison groups. And so, like, I think our job in perinatal psychiatry is really to be able to integrate all those years of studies and be able to explain to patients, you know, what seems to be true risk and what is not. And when I'm talking to patients and families about this, I really want to target what I think their concerns are, so that they come in with a certain question. So good studies are going to be well controlled in terms of controlling for confounding variables. You know, there may be control groups also to compare to. Ideally, controls though will have the same disorder as the individuals on the medication in order to ascertain what might be a contributing factor from the medication. But patients often come in with specific questions, like, do SSRIs increase the risk of autism? No, they don't. They actually absolutely do not. We have enough data now that that's clear. But what happened is that in the past, there were studies that were not well controlled that showed that individuals on an antidepressant had an association with an increased risk of having a child with autism. So not controlling for other factors. So decades later, after maternal mental health is controlled for, the SSRI antidepressants do not appear to be associated with autism. So we now have so much data on this. We have reviews of reviews, you know, on this topic right now. And so you would think that we could reassure people, but if someone doesn't like live in this zone, like I do, like I have the luxury of being able to go over the all the literature on this. But if someone is trying to counsel a patient, or a patient finds the information on autism from a very old study, like out of context, I understand that that would be very alarming, and that scary information really sticks with people. So that's where like our job is to really try and synthesize it for people.
And for our viewers and listeners, you make such an important point about this notion of confounding. I'm not sure if everybody who's listening understands what that means, that when a study gets done, especially what we call an observational study, where you're taking a large group of people and you're not necessarily controlling for the unique impact of an intervention, and investigators will talk about, well, confounding effects that would bias the outcome. Could you just say a little more for those who may not be familiar with the notion of confounding?
Right. So if the question is, does an SSRI in the first trimester lead to major malformations compared to not being exposed in a first trimester, what else do you have to consider? So first of all, there's the confounding by illness. So the reason that the individual's on the medication, because it may cause detrimental effects either directly or indirectly by some of those factors we talked about earlier, like substance use, obesity, exercise, nutrition, planned pregnancy, prenatal vitamin use, all those things. And the studies are really only as good as the ability to control for all those variables, because otherwise we may mistakenly blame something that is not to blame for some outcome. So for example, at MGH, we have our National Pregnancy Registry for Psychiatric Medications. And the main outcome is looking at first trimester exposures to medication and risk of major malformations. But we're collecting information on just about every obstetrical and neonatal variable in child development in order to really enrich that sample. But we collect all that data. So we collect, everything I was talking about in terms of all those different confounding variables, and along the way, any obstetrical outcomes, other medications are very important to collect, any substance use, over-the-counter medications, supplements. A lot of patients assume some things are safe when they may be in question or not safe. And so what a registry like that does, or a large database where some investigators may look, is to be able to control for all those different variables. And so so you can control for individuals exposed to the medication in question versus those not exposed. And you can look at women and compare, for example, among those who have the same disorders.
So if a patient came to me and said, I want to get pregnant, I've been treated with an SSRI, it's been effective, but I heard this FDA panel say that they're dangerous. One thing I would want to importantly say to the patient is something that the panel didn't really talk about is, how do you know cause and effect? Taking an SSRI side by side with having an untreated depression, being a smoker, being obese, having poor prenatal care, having substance use disorders, having poor social supports, there must be many, 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 many factors that could go into the outcome of a pregnancy, untreated depression being not the least of it. But the FDA didn't really quite cast that context of how do you understand any risk, if any, from really any intervention relative to those confounders, huh?
Well, I think that there's some background information that we also need to emphasize to patients and healthcare providers, and that's that pregnancy is inherently risky. So the rate of major malformations in this country is something like 3 to 4% in the background population. So that's without exposure to psychiatric medications. But I really think that pregnant women can't think about that every day and like get up and function. That's terrifying. So sometimes when people think about risks, or they hear something about risks, in their mind they're comparing it to the risk of not taking something being nothing. And we know that even without medication exposure, that pregnancy complications and complications for the child, major malformations even, are common. These are common. So what we're trying to do is take every variable for that individual patient, make very patient-centered decisions with information about that patient and her history, and also her values. So, you know, for many patients, you know, we always want to look at the severity of the illness and how recurrent it's been. We tend to see people who have had, you know, very severe depression, very recurrent depression, and are at very high risk of relapse for coming off the medication. But we also never prescribe or recommend medication in a vacuum. So we always recommend some form of psychotherapy, support, good nutrition, exercise, you know, a lot of non-pharmacologic treatments along with it. So we can't actually give people like a breakdown on exactly how less risky it is with exercise or, you know, those kind of things. I actually think in our field, one of the most neglected topics is sort of the groundbreaking value of prenatal vitamins and folic acid, because those are very important to take before someone even conceives. So folic acid periconception, so even before conception, has been found to reduce the risk of birth defects, especially central nervous system defects in the that occur in the very beginning of pregnancy. And then through pregnancy, folic acid is important in terms of neurodevelopment. So one of the things that I think for those of us who treat reproductive age women that may become pregnant is to recommend a simple addition of a multivitamin, which would have a pretty decent amount of folic acid. And for any woman who's pregnant or planning pregnancy, higher doses of folic acid. So we always want people to be living their most healthy life, and especially during pregnancy, where that really resonates with people. So it's a complex picture. So it's not just we can't, you know, we're not treating rats. You know, there was an overemphasis on animal data in that panel, and we're treating people who have lives and families and so many variables and environmental concerns, and so we have to take that all together. And so I think that the decisions are always like patient-centered, like for that person with their history, and also collaborative. So there are always going to be things we don't know, and pregnancy is a time where there are a lot of outcomes we don't know. You know, there are things we know, and then, you know, there are things, for example, some medications that have been less studied, but we have to sort of do a risk-benefit analysis with the best data that we have at the time, and also how the medications work for an individual. So in terms of that risk-benefit, we have to know what the benefit is to really accept a risk, even if it's not a known risk or a very low risk. So if a woman is not deriving benefit from the medication she's on, that really makes a case to find something else or take her off it. And we really want to find out what works for someone, ideally before they conceive.
Before they get pregnant. Mm-hmm. And I imagine it's important to not just think depression, right? A woman who's had three or more prior depressive episodes, perhaps with a history of a suicide attempt or hospitalization or comorbidities, is just going to pose really a higher risk pregnancy, mm-hmm. right? Compared to somebody, well, with less severe illness or less chronic or less highly recurrent illness. So it's a little hard to say one size fits all, I would think.
Right. And there is absolutely a role for psychotherapy in terms of perhaps some patients needing less medication or being able to come off medication. So there have been studies, for example, looking at very intensive evidence-based psychotherapies like mindfulness-based cognitive therapy to see about preventing relapse of depression during pregnancy and the postpartum. Part of the problem, too, we want to be able to offer everyone really scalable options for evidence-based psychotherapy, really the gold standard for any woman who's in that situation of recurrent and severe depression would be psychotherapy plus medication.
Any importance about trimesters? So organogenesis is the first trimester, but then there's obstetrical complications later. Do you ever say things like, Let's just get you the first trimester, or let's try to not stop the medicine in the third trimester. How do you think about the timing of trimesters and exposures?
So I'm in a good position in that I round with probably the largest group of perinatal psychiatrists like every week at our Center for Women's Mental Health. And I think collectively over the years, we've changed our practice. So for example, with some medications, we might have tried to stop a medication for the first trimester and then restart it later. However, we've seen so many patients relapse and relapse so severely that we don't do that anymore. So as long as a medication is reasonable during pregnancy, we would continue it throughout the first trimester, especially if someone had a severe illness. But the one thing I want to say about the third trimester, the thing that is most misunderstood, is that it's been reported now for about 20 years that about 25% to 30% of babies may have some symptoms after delivery if the mom is on an antidepressant in the third trimester. So in our field, we call this poor neonatal adaptation. And when it was reported initially, without any study, and I'm talking zero human study, no clinical study whatsoever, the FDA put into all the labels that women should seriously consider stopping their antidepressants in the third trimester. So I will say, really, as a field, collectively, perinatal psychiatrists said, time out, wait, we're not doing that. Because women who are at the greatest risk of severe postpartum illness are the individuals who are on medication in the first place. And we talked about before how we don't want women to be ill when they're taking a new baby home from the hospital. So we just talk about this with patients. We explain that about a third, up to about a third of women may have babies with some symptoms. We would never know for sure if it's due to the antidepressant or not, but the typical symptoms are mild and short-lived and tend to include, with SSRI, some jitteriness, fussiness, crying that go away usually pretty quickly and do not require medical management. So and sometimes they don't occur at all. But I talk about this with every single patient, and I want their partners to hear it also, because this is the topic that most women get the most misinformation about. So many healthcare providers will tell a patient to stop their antidepressant in the third trimester. And I've had patients have the terrible experience of being in the hospital for labor and delivery, which is such a vulnerable time, mm-hmm. and have been told in a judgmental way, don't you know you were supposed to stop taking that? And then the woman, her soul is crushed. You know, this individual who's in the major life transition of becoming a mother was just told she's done something majorly wrong. And she's just in the hospital to deliver the baby. So to me, that's heartbreaking. That's just crushing. So I want patients to be like the world's expert on the topic about this, because they are so likely to encounter misinformation from some healthcare provider.
The word misinformation has to figure prominently.
Right.
Right.
Right. Right. But I think that our best strategy is really to provide the education. And so, you know, one of the missions of our group is to have our website, which is www.womensmentalhealth.org, which provides new information as it comes out. We have an editor-in-chief, actually, of the website, Dr. Ruta Nonax, to provide information for patients and families. And Postpartum Support International has great resources for patients and families. You know, because we realize not everyone is going to be able to see a perinatal psychiatrist. And so what we want to make sure is people have all the educational resources possible.
Wow. I have a couple more questions, then we should wrap up. So one of the comments that came out of this panel was the question of whether or not a boxed warning should be applied to SSRIs. What kinds of consequences do you think might occur if such a thing happens?
I have to honestly say, I don't know. You know, I don't know what this FDA is going to do. I don't know if there was an agenda for that meeting, because to me, it's puzzling why there was so much emphasis on animal data and non-clinical data. I think that, I'm not an expert on what a black box warning might do to prescriptions. You know, there are plenty of medications that have black box warnings that we use regularly. We always want to be respectful of a medication and side effects, but I don't think that this is this class of medication requires more caution at this time. So I wouldn't suggest label changes. And for some background on the labels, just recently in about 2015, the labels were all changed in the pregnancy section, which is section 8 of the package insert. So the FDA used to assign a letter to the medication on pregnancy safety, so A, B, C, D, X. And at the time of letter assignment, there was usually zero human pregnancy data. It was usually based on a small amount of animal data. And so after many decades, those letters went away because they really didn't make sense. They didn't help weigh the medication's risks and benefits. So now if you look in that section, there's a summary of what's known about human exposure to that medication, like first and foremost, and also if there's a registry, a human registry for that study that's FDA approved in terms of its science, and also if the information is available, what the use of that medication, you know, how, you know, are outcomes different than controls with the same disorder or who, you know, patients with the same illness, either exposed or not exposed to that medication. So the package inserts actually have changed in recent years. So that was actually a big development. And I think we're just, that healthcare providers are just wrapping their heads around that.
Yeah. I'd be worried that a labeling change would serve to be fear-mongering and stigmatizing and feed more misinformation and dissuade women and practitioners from having transparent dialogues about pros and cons and risks and benefits, particularly given the things that you're saying about untreated depression as neurotoxic, both to women and to a developing fetus. It doesn't really foster the dialogue that I think we're trying to foster.
I would like to add one more thing.
Please.
So, as a field, we don't lack concern about all medications. I don't want it to seem like we're laid back about everything. And I do feel it's important to mention that there's one glaring exception in our field, and that's valproic acid or Depakote, which has the worst risk of teratogenicity or birth defects associated with it. And many women don't know they're pregnant right away. And with valproic acid, the major risks for major malformations occur very early. And then the information just keeps getting worse because valproic acid is associated with poorer neurodevelopmental outcomes with exposures, you know, really throughout pregnancy, sort of like alcohol. And so the one medication we don't want women to be on who have reproductive potential or girls younger than that is valproic acid. And so since we have so many other mood stabilizers now, I really think that it should not be introduced because otherwise we have this bind. And we just had a patient presented in our rounds this week of a patient who did very well on valproic acid and now wants to become pregnant. And then the issue is that the individual has to change medications, or the even worst case scenario is she's already pregnant. So I do want to mention that because I think it's so important in our field. And there have been studies that have been done that show women are not counseled about the risks of valproic acid in pregnancy. They're not counseled about using contraception. And even if they are, they often are not using it regularly. Again, we have a pregnancy rate, unplanned pregnancy rate in this country of about 50%. Mm-hmm. So if there's one medication I wish there would have been a panel on, it would have been that.
That was my reaction too, is I quite understand why the SSRIs are being singled out when there are other medicines that you mentioned, valproates, I might think about carbamazepine as well, that actually do have some potential teratogenic risks. And so it's not really fair, I think, to just sort of broadly speak about a drug class without getting a little more nuanced and granular about what is known, where there's risk, where there's not risk, and also how to do the risk benefit analyses that we all must do.
And as long as you mention that, you know, there are many medications that are prescribed for other disorders than psychiatric disorders. So for other medical conditions where there's next to nothing known about them during pregnancy. So, mm-hmm. you know, what I wish would have happened would have been a panel that was convened to look at what medicines do we really need to study and have really accurate risk benefit discussions around across all fields of medicine, you know, not just targeting psychiatry and the most commonly used antidepressants, you know, which seems to not be part of a strategic plan.
Yeah. Well said, well spoken. Well, Marlene, this has been a wonderful opportunity, I think, certainly for me, and I'm sure for our listeners to get some top line insights about what's really known in the treatment of depression and pregnancy and how to think about these topics with clarity and scientific rigor. Any final thoughts you want to add before we sign off?
No, I just want to thank you for including me.
I want to thank you for joining us. Well, thank you all for joining us today, and I hope you found this helpful, and we will look forward to seeing you again real soon. So bye for now.
Thank you.
This This podcast is presented by Psychiatric Times, the number one psychiatric publication in the U.S. Visit us at psychiatrictimes.com for the latest clinical news, expert perspectives, and CME opportunities. Thank you for listening.